Father Clock at the entrance of the Oval Office with the news. George, David Gergen's going to be joining us. Don't worry, we'll make it work for you. Then he hurried out the door to meet with Gergen. The president was back in his study, and all I could do was go home. My high from the House victory on the economic plan was now dampened by how I knew the Gergen appointment would look, like I'd been fired. The next morning, Mac told me he hoped to announce the appointment after the long Memorial Day weekend. Then he left for Arkansas. Hoping to minimize the appearance that Gergen was coming in to replace me, I started to think about ways we could separate any announcement of my job shift from the news of Gergen's appointment. But once a decision like this is made, the details rarely hold for more than a day. By midday Friday, Wolf Blitzer had the story. "What's this about David Gergen coming in?" he asked. With nothing to say, I had to stall. "I'll get back to you, Wolf." Then I tried to find someone who knew what was going on, but it was futile. Mac was in Arkansas, and Clinton was traveling too. Gore told me everything would work out, but said I had to talk to Mac or the president for the details. With Clinton not scheduled to call until late that night, I killed some time over an Indian dinner with my deputy, David Dreyer. Only here did I vent my resentment. They're blaming everything on the kids. But it wasn't the kids who chose Zoe. It wasn't the kids who got their hair cut or fired the travel office. No, we kids didn't make all those decisions, but we were part of the problem. I was part of the problem. And our headstrong clash with the Washington culture was obstructing the rest of our agenda. Here's where Gergen would help. He was the ultimate establishment man. That much I understood. But why did it have to be a Reagan guy? We were elected to reverse the Reagan Revolution, not celebrate it. Choosing Gergen was adding ideological injury to personal insult. Obviously, the president didn't think so. He liked the bipartisan glow that Gergen would add to our team. I finally went to bed around midnight with no word from Clinton. As far as I knew, the official announcement was days away, and I was heading to California for the rest of the holiday weekend. But my phone rang at 1:36 a.m. It was the president. "George, I'm sorry to wake you," he said in his most soothing voice. "I know you already talked to Mac about this Gergen thing, but I wanted to call now because we have to do this tomorrow. I know this is for the best, and I want you to believe it. I need to have you close by me." His words echoed in my head. "I need to have you close by me." Exactly the words I needed to hear. I fell asleep feeling better already. The words the rest of the world would hear were another story. The announcement was scheduled for the ridiculous hour of 7:30 on a Saturday morning. I went to my office around 6:30, booked myself on a later flight to California, and walked into Mac's already crowded office. Gergen was at the table, sipping coffee, and he got up immediately to pull me aside for a few gracious words. The vice president was sitting at a word processor in the outer office, tapping out the president's statement, with Dee Dee and Mark Guerin standing over his shoulder to watch out for my interests. Knowing that the statement would be dissected for clues to my new status the way Kremlinologists used to study May Day photos in Pravda, I wanted the same title as Gergen, counselor. But he resisted, so my new title was the nebulous Senior Advisor for Policy and Strategy. Only time would tell what it would mean. A little after 7:30, the president arrived in the Oval. Before heading to the Rose Garden, he approached me first and congratulated me on my new job. What new job? Nobody's really said what I'm going to do. But Clinton's touch was perfect. Now if only I could convince the rest of the world to congratulate me. I hadn't prepared a statement of my own, but my actual words wouldn't matter much. My mission was to look like a man who was getting promoted. Inside, I felt like a little kid who was being punished for something that wasn't his fault. Standing next to Clinton and Gergen didn't help. They both had nearly 10 inches on me. I fixed a big smile on my face and stared straight into the cameras, determined not to look like a loser. But when Clinton started to compliment me, my reflexive reaction was a modest, momentary bow of the head. The sound of 1,000 cicadas ravaging through a field snapped my head back up, but the photographers had the shot that told the story. Brash young presidential aide, head bowed in humiliation, the agony of defeat etched on his face. My comeback strategy could wait until Monday. Now I just wanted that weekend off. But I hadn't lost all my chutzpah. Before I headed to the airport, Mac asked me if there was anything he could do for me. "Thanks for asking. Can we start with a raise?" He laughed, but I got the money, and a small piece of evidence that I really had been promoted. Right then, Malibu was the best place for me to be. At a diner by the beach, A group of college kids who were listening to the radio came by my table to congratulate me. Hey, maybe this is going better than I thought. Wrong. I may have been playing okay in the town where only no publicity is bad publicity, but on the East Coast, my public double was taking a beating. For every winner in a Washington power play, there must be a loser. That weekend, it was me. The Times story was headlined, "An Offering to the Wolves." On the flight back Monday afternoon, I plotted out a strategy. My touchstone was a piece of advice phoned in from former Congressman Tony Coelho. "Nobody will remember what happened to you," he said. "They'll remember how you handle it." My first day back would set the tone. My whole staff gathered in my office to help me prepare for my final press conference. The substance I could handle, but the style would matter more. A little California sun helped, and I had shaved extra close that morning. Even more important was my opening line. Do I act like nothing's happened and get right to work? No, that would ring false, look like I'm in denial. Everyone's going to ask about it anyway. Someone suggested Mark Twain's old saw about reports of my death have been greatly exaggerated. No, too obvious and too defensive. What I needed was something light, a little ironic, with just the right touch of self-deprecation. I had to acknowledge that the press had won and show good-humored dignity in defeat. Gene Sperling came up with the line. So, how was your weekend? My comeback had begun. Relieved from the burdens of managing a 50-person staff and confronting a dyspeptic press corps, I was free to do the job I did pretty well. The job I'd first started doing for Clinton early in the campaign. Which was what exactly? Mostly it was just to be there, by the president's side, to help give background to the press on the president's thinking and background to him on theirs, to know what was going on, what the president should say, and how to get things done, to help corral decisions to closure, assess the political impact of policy decisions, and contain mistakes before they became scandals. When August turns Washington into a 10-square-mile steam bath, the best place to be is the U.S. Capitol. Its marble columns and polished stone floors throw off a chill like ice blocks in an old Frigidaire, and the air conditioning is cranked up high for the comfort of congressmen chafing under the perennial pre-recess pressures, all-night sessions, cliffhanger votes, and non-refundable airline tickets for the family vacation. But on August 5, 1993, even the Capitol wasn't cool enough for Senator Bob Kerry. It felt more like a pressure cooker. Gaggles of reporters pursued him through the halls. Republicans were reaching out to him. Democrats were trying to reel him in, and the White House was bearing down on him. Clinton's bitter rival in 1992, Senator Kerry was the final undecided vote on Clinton's economic plan, the legislation that would make or break Clinton's presidency. Would Kerry be the 50th yes? Or the 51st no. That morning, the president called him from the Oval. I didn't hear what Kerry said, and I didn't really need to. Clinton's increasingly heated responses told the whole story. If you want to bring this presidency down, then go ahead. Maybe I ought to just pick it up and go back to Little Rock. My presidency's going to go down. Fuck you. Fine, okay. If that's what you want, you go do it. But when Clinton hung up the receiver, his voice was flat. Matter of fact, almost shell-shocked. It's going to be a no, he said. I didn't believe it. Besides, Friday's Senate vote was a lifetime away. If we lost tonight's House vote, tomorrow wouldn't even matter. So Clinton and I spent the afternoon in the Oval, working the phones. From my chair pushed up against the president's desk, I was the link between Clinton and the House Democrats, between my old life and my new. But there was one huge difference. This time we weren't looking for enough no's to defeat a president's program, or enough yeas for a symbolic show of force before the inevitable veto. Passing this economic plan, with all of its compromises and imperfections, was what we were elected to do. The opposite of Reaganomics, it reduced the deficit by raising taxes on the wealthy, while cutting them for the working poor, and preserving social programs for the poor and middle class. If it worked, interest rates would keep coming down, the economy would continue to grow, average Americans would be better off, and Clinton would get reelected. By early evening, we'd hit a wall. 208 hard yeses, 10 short. All the main players, Gore, Benson, Rubin, Altman, Panetta, came to the Oval, the way everyone gravitates towards the kitchen at family reunions. It's the place to be when there's nothing left to do, except worry. They paced around the president's desk and chomped on cookies. Clinton's nerves showed on the shredded butt end of the unlit cigar he'd been chewing all afternoon. My blood-red cuticles betrayed me. But for the first time in our entire relationship, I was more optimistic than my boss. Usually I was the dark one. He was Mr. Lucky. Now our roles were reversed. Maybe it was because I knew the house and its rhythms, knew that the body needed a victory, even if its members didn't want to vote for it. The final vote was 218 yeses, 216 noes, not a vote to spare. The president's study erupted in a riot of hugs that soon subsided into sober relief. Clinton wasn't ready to celebrate. We'd live to fight another day, but learned another painful lesson in the limits of presidential power. After all the threats and promises, after all the carefully crafted compromises and absurdly trivial deals, I'd really like to play golf with the president. All we could do was watch on TV with the other C-SPAN junkies. Our fate, in the end, was out of our hands. Tomorrow, it would be in Bob Kerry's. In return for his vote, Kerry wanted Clinton to make him chairman of a new presidential commission on budget discipline. I didn't like the idea, because I feared that a commission could lock us into a long-term strategy of cutting even more government benefits for people who needed them. But I also knew Kerry had us over a barrel. The vice president was apoplectic at the thought of Kerry trampling on his turf. He thought the commission would overshadow the Reinventing Government initiative he was scheduled to launch in the fall. So Gore's chief of staff, Jack Quinn, and I were deputized to edit Kerry's draft in a way that would reduce the potential conflict with the vice president. In the end, we managed to weaken Kerry's mandate by expanding it, renaming the group the White House Commission on Economic Priorities. A commission that broad would inevitably become nothing more than a debating society. But Kerry didn't budge, and the negotiation shifted to Majority Leader Mitchell's office in the Capitol. We followed the full floor debate on C-SPAN. Every senator already knew how every other senator was voting, and waited for Kerry to announce that he'd made up his mind. The call finally came to the Oval at 8:20 p.m. Clinton was silent. He just chewed his lip and nodded his head to the rhythm of the upright thumb he was pumping in my direction. After 48 hours filled with screams, threats, promises, and demands, Kerry had just called to tell the president, "This one's for free." So we won, and our plan did work. The party-line Republican position that Clinton's plan would be a job-killing poison for the economy was flat wrong. At the time, we couldn't have imagined how right we were, but we did know that we'd be in a world of hurt if we lost. A failed vote would mean a failed presidency. Winning meant redemption and a second chance. Forget about Zoe, Waco, haircut, Travelgate. We passed our economic plan. Did what we were elected to do. The economy's stupid, remember? But we didn't just dodge a bullet, we did some good. An uber wonk with a heart as pure as you'll find in politics, Gene Sperling gave a speech to the staff in the Roosevelt Room that put the whole ordeal in perspective. "People say I'm too obsessed with numbers," he said while glancing down at a sweaty scrap of paper. "Well, let me tell you some numbers. 100,000 poor mothers and their babies will be healthier because of the child nutrition program. 100,000 more poor kids will get to go to Head Start. 15 million working families will get a tax cut with their earned income tax credit. And 20 million more young people will get student loans at better rates." Reducing the deficit was what we had to do, but we also did a little of what we wanted to do, what we cared about when we first started. "Webb? It's George. I'm afraid I have some bad news."
"What is it?"
"Vince killed himself."
"What?
Vince killed, what?"
"Vince, I'm sorry. Vince, what? I don't believe it."
7 times he asked. 7 times I answered. It was a little before 9:30 on the night of July 20th, 1993. I found Webb Hubble from a phone by the map room on the first floor of the residence. Only minutes before, Bill Burton, an assistant to Mac McLarty, had crashed through the colonnade with the news. Vince Foster's body had been found in a wooded area off the GW Parkway. Early signs pointed to suicide. By the next morning, official Washington's highest-ranking suicide since Secretary of Defense James Forrestal in 1949 was fast becoming a political scandal. Inside the White House, we were captured by grief, confused by the inherent inexplicability of suicide, and convinced that we had a duty to preserve as much privacy as possible for both the Fosters and the Clintons. Focused on ourselves, we walked through the halls with careful looks, huddled in corners, and consoled each other with a touch on the shoulder or a hug. "Are you okay? Are you sure? Do you want to talk?" If this could happen to Vince, Clinton's Rock of Gibraltar, maybe it could happen to anyone.
Trying to comfort us, the president called a staff meeting. He told us to understand that what happened to Vince was a mystery about something inside of him, and reminded us that we're all people and that we have to pay a little more attention to our friends and our families and our co-workers. At his own press conference, Mac McClarty echoed the theme. Try as we might, all of our reason, all of our rationality, all of our logic can never answer the questions raised by such a death. Somewhat less elegantly, I told the Washington Post, the fundamental truth is that no one can know what drives a person to do something like this. Since you can't ever know, it's impossible to speculate on it. In the end, it's a mystery. This was the White House line, and I believed it was true. But it made sense to the world only if you understood what we were feeling inside, only if you were part of our family. To more skeptical ears, Clinton's refusal to speculate on Vince's psychological state and our preemptive insistence that Vince's suicide could not be explained by examining his White House work sounded like we were trying to shut down a legitimate inquiry, which guaranteed, of course, that this was just the beginning. At a White House briefing a week after Vince's death, Dee Dee was asked 139 questions about the Foster case. Over the next month, the Times and the Post each published 6 front-page stories on the suicide, and William Safire used his column to make it a cause célèb. Combine the predictable press interest with Vince's involvement in the travel office imbroglio, with our claim that the White House counsel had to control Vince's papers to preserve his attorney-client privilege with the Clintons, with the confusion over who had been in Vince's office and what had been done there, with the belated discovery and release of a torn-up note from the bottom of Foster's briefcase, combine all that and you have the circumstantial seeds of a full-blown scandal. By trying to preserve a measure of Foster's privacy, we invited more invasive scrutiny. By thinking like lawyers, we risk being questioned like criminals. By emphasizing the mystery of suicide, we appeared to be manufacturing a cover-up. Our human reaction was read through the prism of post-Watergate politics. Every president is Nixon until proven innocent. On July 21st, the Park Police said that Foster's injury was, quote, not inconsistent with that of a self-inflicted wound. By August 11th, that was their official finding. Subsequent investigations by 2 independent counsels, congressional committees, and countless investigative reporters may not have convinced ardent conspiracy theorists, but they have confirmed beyond any reasonable doubt that Vince Foster shot himself in Fort Marcy Park, Virginia, on July 20th, 1993. Why he did it, we still can't really know. How history will eventually judge Vince Foster and the president we both served is also not known. But a few weeks before his death, in an interview with Margaret Carlson of Time, Vince may have revealed what he most feared. His achingly laconic lament is a fair warning for those who aspire to high White House service. Before we came here, we thought of ourselves as good people. By the end of 1993, more trouble was closing in. This time it came from the Ozark home of the busted land deal that began when I was a senior in high school and Bill Clinton was Attorney General of Arkansas. Whitewater. After an early 1992 flurry precipitated by a New York Times investigation, the issue faded after our campaign commissioned an audit that documented how much money the Clintons lost on the investment. The Republicans couldn't effectively exploit the issue because President Bush's son, Neil Bush, had come under fire for his own involvement with a failed savings and loan. But late in 1993, the Resolution Trust Corporation, a government agency established to manage the aftermath of the 1980 savings and loan crisis, asked the Justice Department to open a criminal investigation of Madison Guarantee, the SNL managed by Jim McDougal, the Clintons' Whitewater partner. David Hale, a former judge and business associate of McDougal's, who was trying to worm his way out of a fraud indictment, offered prosecutors and the press a new hook by alleging that Governor Clinton had pressured him to lend McDougal money. These new developments, coupled with the miasma of mystery surrounding Vince Foster's suicide, piqued the interest of the Times and the Washington Post. They asked again to review all the Whitewater documents, and a series of fax questions from the Post sat in the White House for weeks without a formal response. To me, Whitewater was old news, the obsession of a few conspiracy theorists. But by early December, the Post was convinced we were hiding something sinister. Executive editor Leonard Downey made a series of extraordinary personal requests for the documents, and reporter Ann Devroy warned me that the paper would go on the war path unless we answered their questions and released the documents. I wish we had. If a genie offered me the chance to turn back time and undo a single decision from my White House tenure, I'd head straight to the Oval Office dining room on Saturday morning, December 11, 1993. The night before, Bernie Nussbaum, David Kendall, Clinton's private attorney, and Hillary had persuaded the president to stonewall the post. All three were tough trial attorneys who were determined to follow a close-hold strategy more appropriate for corporate litigation than presidential politics. They all underestimated the media reality that reporters want most what they're told they can't have. The political reality that the president's right to privacy is limited by the public's right to know. And the cultural reality that the country probably wouldn't care about the ins and outs of an old land deal as long as it didn't look like the Clintons had something to hide. On Saturday morning, just after the radio address, Mac McClarty gave Gergen and me one last chance to convince Clinton the only way to kill the story was to cooperate with the Post. The president was sitting at the head of his small oval table, sipping a mug of decaf with a pile of folders in front of him. Gergen and I were on either side. For once, though, the two of us were arguing the same case. Although we often clashed on policy matters, we both insisted now that turning over the Whitewater documents was the only way to manage the story. The president seemed to agree. "I don't have a big problem with giving them what we have," he said, almost apologetically. "But Hillary..." Saying her name flipped a switch in his head. Suddenly, his eyes lit up, and 2 years' worth of venom spewed out of his mouth. You could usually tell when Clinton was making Hillary's argument. Even if he was yelling, his voice had a flat quality, as if he were a high school debater speeding through a series of memorized facts. Their anti-press script was familiar to me by now. "No, you're wrong," he said. "The questions won't stop. At the Sperling breakfast, I answered more questions about my private life than any candidate ever. And what did that get me? They'll always want more. No president has ever been treated like I've been treated." Gergen did his best to calm Clinton down. Having worked for Nixon, Ford, and Reagan, he'd seen what happens when a president is accused of covering up. He also tried to make the case that the Post would treat Clinton fairly. Still battle-scarred from the campaign scandals and the snafus of our first 6 months, I tried a different tack, hoping to convince Clinton by invoking our shared experience. "Mr. President, you're right. You have gotten a raw deal from the press, and the stories they write will be unpleasant. But they can't really hurt you because they're all about the past, and you didn't do anything wrong. If we don't give the papers what they want, they'll say we're covering up. The pressure will build, and we'll end up answering the questions later anyway. Better to flush it out over the holidays while no one's paying attention." For a moment, I thought our rare double-team effort had worked. Clinton didn't make a counter-argument. The Paul in him knew we were right. But on this issue, Clinton wasn't commander-in-chief, just a husband beholden to his wife. Hillary was always the first to defend him on bimbo eruptions. Now he had to do the same for her. Gergen and I didn't know what was in the Whitewater documents, but whatever it was, Hillary didn't want it out, and she had a veto. The president ended the meeting by saying he wanted to think about it some more. Later that afternoon, Mac called Gergen to tell him we were standing firm. But the strategy failed, and over the Christmas holidays, the controversy approached critical mass. By January, the Republicans were demanding a special counsel to investigate Whitewater, and all we talked about inside the White House was what to do. Although I publicly delivered the party line against the special prosecutor on the Brinkley Show, inside the White House, I was arguing that we had to request a special counsel before it was forced on us. Ever since Watergate, whenever a president or other high-level government official was accused of wrongdoing, an outside counsel had been appointed. After the first couple of meetings, we reached consensus. Only Nussbaum was holding out. Joel Klein, his deputy, was dispatched to broach the matter with Hillary, but she shut him down. 2 hours later, Harold and Mac tried again. The answer was still no. When they returned with the news, about a dozen of us were scattered around Mac McClarty's office. Some sat at the conference table in the far corner, some by the fireplace. I was folded over the wingback chair by Mac's desk, facing the door, griping openly about the magnitude of our mistake. Then she walked in. The whole room dropped dead silent. "Well," said Hillary crisply, taking a seat on the couch by the door, "I think this is a meeting I ought to be at." "I might as well go on with what I was saying," I said. Sitting up straight and staring right at Hillary, I made my case. "Assuming we did nothing wrong, the best thing is to have a special counsel say so. There's an air of inevitability to this. If we don't ask for one from the Attorney General, we're going to get an independent prosecutor. Congress will keep the drumbeat going, they'll pass the Independent Counsel Act, and the court will appoint one. I know we didn't do anything wrong, but it looks like we did because we're not being forthcoming. More important than anything else, this is going to kill healthcare if we don't get it under control. This debate will sap us for the next 30, 60, 90 days, as long as we keep up the fight. If you want us to fight Hillary, we will. We can beat this back. But it will take all our time, all our staff resources, and most important, all our political capital, which we need every bit of to pass healthcare. I thought that final argument was the coup de grace, the killer point she couldn't counter. Instead, it struck at her deepest fear, that after all of her hard work, after all her sacrifice, after all the indignities of the campaign and the frustrations of the first year, the project that would make it all worthwhile, healthcare, would be crippled by scandal. Cornered, she struck back. What do you mean Congress won't stop? You told me that if we gave everything to the Justice Department, that would end it. It didn't end it. Now the Congress wants them? If we were as tough as the Republicans, we'd band together and beat them back. I tried to stay calm, answering point by point. Hillary, the Democrats are still holding firm, but I can't promise they'll be with us in a month. It's beyond the Congress now. It's in the editorial pages. It's everywhere. We don't get the benefit of the doubt because we're not being forthcoming and we are being defensive. Whatever I said was exactly wrong. Tears stung the corners of her eyes, and I imagined Hillary's fear-induced fury. At the Republicans for trying to destroy healthcare by destroying her. At the press for their small-minded, obsessive scrupulousness when issues affecting real people were at stake. At her husband for getting her into this stupid land deal with his shady friends in the first place and then expecting her to clean it up. At her best friend Vince for killing himself. At herself for letting the situation spiral out of control. All of that fury, for a moment, was directed right at me. You never believed in us. In New Hampshire, it was just me and Susan and Harold who believed in us. If we wouldn't have fought, we would have never won. You gave up on us. Pausing, her voice fell, and Hillary started to cry. We were out there alone, and I'm feeling very lonely right now. Nobody's fighting for me. Everyone seemed stuck to their chairs, not knowing whether to be unnerved, afraid, or consoling. I was too stunned to respond. Harold Ickes, who had been explicitly absolved from the accusation of disloyalty, tried to rescue me with one final plea for reconsideration. I don't want to hear anything more, Hillary snapped, back in control. I want us to fight. I want to campaign now. Looking back at me, she took one last shot. If you don't believe in us, you should just leave. Then she walked out the door. A dead moment passed. I fixed a crinkly smile on my face. Once I was sure Hillary was long gone, I rose to leave too. Nice try, Dee Dee whispered. I walked the few steps to my office, closed the door behind me, and broke down. You gave up on us. How could she say that? Nobody's fought harder for them. I'm the most loyal staffer they've ever had. I went out there every day. On Jennifer and the draft and Whitewater. Sacrificed my credibility. I went out there on faith without the facts and would get killed, just humiliated. No matter what I thought inside, I went before the whole country like a crazy person. Even said I believed he never had sex with Jennifer. People would laugh at what I would say. Then to get attacked? Not for being wrong, but for being disloyal, for abandoning them? Fuck her. I'm arguing for what's best, for her, for him, for all of us and everything we're fighting for. Fuck her. But I also knew why Hillary's words wounded me so deeply. They were true. I never showed it to the world, but I did give up in New Hampshire. On the floor of that yogurt factory when we received the forgotten draft letter. In my Little Rock office when I heard Clinton talking to Jennifer Flowers on the tapes. Remembering all that made me feel sorry for Hillary. She'd had to listen to those tapes too. She'd had to gulp hard on primetime television when Sam Donaldson read back her husband's farewell to Jennifer. Goodbye, baby. She'd had to pull it all together every single day, for him and for Chelsea, and she never really knew what was coming next either. And all for what? Not just to be First Lady, but to do big things. Now her integrity was being questioned. Everything she'd worked for was imperiled, and no one was there for her. The morning after my confrontation with Hillary, the Post had published another breathless but mind-numbing 2018-word front-page story going over all of the details. At 7:15 a.m., A good hour and a half before the president usually arrived in the West Wing, Clinton burst through the back door of my office holding a newspaper. I braced myself for another blast, but it never came. Maybe Clinton was trying to compensate for Hillary's broadside by keeping me close. Maybe he saw something in the article I missed. Whatever the reason, the president was bubbling with excitement. "Mr. President, I know you think the story's great, but I don't get it. You really have to explain to me why you think it's great." "Oh, don't you see," he said, showing me the paragraphs he'd underlined and starred. "It's full of factually untrue stuff, and it shows that even career attorneys from the Justice Department saw no reason to pursue the case." The article did, in fact, make that point, adding that, quote, "there was no conclusive evidence that the Clintons had done anything illegal." But it also repeated the suggestion that the involvement of the first couple had impeded the progress of the investigation. Putting these two arguments together, I made one last plea. "You may be right, Mr. President, and I know you guys didn't do anything wrong. That's why I think it's best to turn this whole thing over to a special counsel so we can get back to work." That makes some sense. Then he went back upstairs to change. When he returned to the Oval an hour later for another meeting with me, Harold, and Mac, Clinton said he knew it was the right thing to do. But a little later, we were back in McLarty's office, the same group going over the same ground, when first Harold and then Mac got called to the Oval. They returned, chastened and pale, and it didn't take a detective to figure out what had happened. "You all can keep talking about this if you want," Icky said, "but it's useless. We're not doing a special counsel." But blocking a special counsel was an unwinnable battle. Over the next few days, our defenses completely crumbled after the Post reported that our delivery of documents to the Justice Department was not, as we had claimed, strictly voluntary. When David Kendall had first contacted Justice to discuss the matter, he'd been informed that the department was already drafting a subpoena for the documents. Kendall subsequently negotiated with department lawyers to broaden the subpoena for the purpose of shielding more documents from the press, another fact we failed to reveal at the time. Although this sort of maneuver was routine and appropriate in private litigation, it reinforced the cover-up charge and raised a new allegation of improper presidential interference with an independent investigation. By Tuesday, January 11th, 9 Democratic senators, led by Pat Moynihan and Bill Bradley, had joined the Republican calls for an independent investigation, which demolished our claim that this was just a partisan witch hunt. 6 months to the day of Vince Foster's suicide, 1 year following President Clinton's first inaugural, Attorney General Janet Reno appointed a Republican former prosecutor and Wall Street lawyer named Robert Fisk to be the Whitewater special counsel. That morning's New York Times poll also found that President Clinton had a higher approval rating than either Reagan or Carter on their first anniversaries in office, and that the American public had more confidence in the economy than at any time since 1990. The pattern of the Clinton presidency was set. On February 10, 1994, 18 minutes of ABC's World News Tonight's 22-minute broadcast was dedicated to Whitewater. By mid-March, the three major network newscasts had spent 220 minutes on the fallout from Whitewater, three times what they gave to healthcare. This saturation coverage reinforced our bunker mentality, which only made matters worse. The tighter we crouched, the harder they hit, and the stories just kept on coming. Clinton accuser David Hale cut a deal with Special Counsel Fisk. Congressional hearings were held on whether the administration tried to derail the Whitewater investigation. A Post story revealed previously undisclosed White House Treasury contacts about the inquiry, precipitating a raft of subpoenas to the White House and the resignation of White House counsel Bernie Nussbaum. The Times also discovered that Hillary Clinton had parlayed a $1,000 investment into a $100,000 profit in the late 1970s commodities market, which provided a plausible theory on why she'd been so adamant about refusing to publicly release the Whitewater documents. The only real news in the documents, which would have included the Clintons' 1978-79 tax returns, would have been Hillary's windfall. Other Rose Law Firm partners who had come to Washington with Hillary faced personal ethical problems. Her Rose Law Firm partner, Webb Hubbell, resigned from the Justice Department over a billing dispute with the Rose Law Firm, which later became the basis for a fraud and embezzlement conviction. Whitewater became the catch-all term for any allegation of unseemliness or impropriety against anyone anywhere near the Clintons or the White House, and it stuck. Health care and the rest of our legislative agenda were stalled, and the president's approval ratings drifted down. In April, Richard Nixon died. On the morning of the funeral, I went to the Oval with Clinton's new communications director, Don Baer, for a final review of Clinton's eulogy. The draft was okay, but one line made me squirm. The president wanted to conclude his remarks by declaring, "The day of judging Richard Nixon based on one part of his life alone has finally come to a close." It was a generous line, too generous. For Bill Clinton to issue such a new and sweeping, if only rhetorical, presidential pardon of Nixon would be both presumptuous and provocative. Nixon, hating liberals, who already felt betrayed by Clinton, would see the gesture as a hollow pitch to appease the right wing, and would feel that only Nixon's victims, the enemies, the Cambodians, the framers of the Constitution, had the right to forgive him. Clinton-hating conservatives, who would never trust Clinton no matter what he said, would suspect that it was a self-referential plea for personal absolution, a slick maneuver aimed at closing off criticism of Clinton's own conduct. To the punditocracy, this would be the line that launched 1,000 columns comparing the characters of Clinton and Nixon. Although the comment might possibly have passed without notice, the risk wasn't worth the reward. But how do you tell your boss that he's insufficiently self-aware or too altruistic for his own good? Very carefully. I didn't mention the misguided comparisons the Clinton critics were making between Whitewater and Watergate. That would just rile him up. Instead, I wondered aloud if we were going a little too far. "I know what you're trying to say, Mr. President, but people might misinterpret what you mean. What if we soften it a bit by saying, may the day of judging Richard Nixon based on one part of his life alone finally come to a close?" By transforming the draft sentence from a presidential directive into a more personal wish, I thought we could preserve the spirit of Clinton's expression without provoking a partisan backlash. "Yeah, that's good," Clinton said, getting it immediately. Seeing and hearing a liberal like me make this suggestion reminded Clinton of the many people who harbored such strong feelings about Nixon. As I walked the president out to the South Lawn, he reminisced about running for Congress in the wake of Nixon's 1974 resignation. Clinton was defeated in that Democratic year, and he never forgot the words of an old man on the campaign trail who was more prescient than the polls. "You're not going to make it, son," predicted the codger. "Your opponent doesn't have enough stink of Nixon on him to lose." Later that month, we had a new stink to deal with. Mike Isikoff of the Post called to tell me that after months of speculation, Paula Jones had finally decided to file a sexual harassment suit against the president. When the American Spectator's Troopergate story was first published in December 1993, the details about a woman named Paula who wanted to be Governor Clinton's girlfriend hadn't made a particular impression on me. Set against the potentially more serious charge that President Clinton may have offered his Arkansas state troopers federal jobs in return for their silence, it seemed inconsequential. Even if it were true, who cared if Clinton made a pass at a young woman when he was governor? Only on February 11, 1994, when Paula Jones disputed the account and accused Clinton of sexual harassment, did I begin to pay attention. Paula leveled her charge from the epicenter of anti-Clintonism, the annual convention of the Conservative Political Action Committee. No network covered the performance live, but from every report that reached my desk, it sounded like a farcical turn on the original Jennifer Flowers circus, minus the incriminating tapes. Though I didn't relish reliving that experience, I couldn't have scripted it better for us. The whole scene screamed setup job. Paula's chief handler, Cliff Jackson, had been making a cottage industry out of attacking Clinton ever since his involvement with the draft story in 1991. We also heard that Paula had put out feelers for book and movie deals, and that a lawyer close to her had even approached associates of Clinton to ask about a job. By now, I had more experience than I ever would have imagined with situations like this, and it looked and smelled like the kind of cash-for-trash transaction we'd beaten back before. The president's initial reaction reinforced my instincts. When I went to the Oval to get his response, he said he didn't remember Paula. "What does she look like?" he asked. As difficult as it may be to believe, I was convinced. I had seen Clinton dissemble in the past, but this time he seemed genuine. My belief in Clinton, coupled with contempt for his enemies, was motivation enough to mount his defense. Paula's cause was being promoted by the same people who were trying to block everything we believed in. They were threatening to sue Clinton not because they had a strong case, but because that was the hook they needed to get press attention and drag Clinton through the mud. I made my case directly to Tim Russert at NBC, Dottie Lynch of CBS, and Tom Johnson, the president of CNN. It wasn't a hard sell, and ABC was even less inclined to sensationalize the supposed sex scandal because of their 22-minute Whitewater extravaganza the night before. Although we couldn't quash all coverage, our goal was to bury a one-day story inside the Saturday newspapers. Asked to comment, I called the performance a cheap political fundraising trick. Initially, the strategy was effective. The coverage was relatively scanty and slanted our way. But a few days later, Anne Devery called to say we had a problem with the Post. According to her, the story was being debated intensively inside the newspaper. She reported that there was a, quote, real back and forth, including her, executive editor Leonard Downey, the editors Bob Kaiser, Bob Barnes, and Karen DeYoung, and the reporter who was pushing hardest to get Paula's story, his story, in the paper, Mike Isikoff. After talking to Anne, I knew that the only way to kill the story was to convince Downey that it wasn't credible or relevant to Clinton's conduct in the Oval Office. But first I had to talk to Isikoff because he was the beat reporter. Before calling him, Bruce Lindsay and I compiled all the facts, even reviewing Clinton's May 8, 1991 gubernatorial schedule to see if we could prove that Clinton could not have met with Paula when she said. It appeared that Clinton had left the Excelsior Hotel by the time of the claimed encounter, but the people accompanying Clinton that day said he had made an unscheduled afternoon return. We didn't have our silver bullet. But even if we couldn't convincingly disprove Paula's claim, it still came down to a he said, she said. Doesn't the President of the United States deserve the benefit of the doubt? Isikoff didn't think so, and we squared off over the validity of various contemporaneous accounts. But it was a dialogue of the deaf. I believed Clinton. He believed Jones. But the most credible testimony came from Danny Ferguson, the trooper alleged to have escorted Paula to Clinton's courtesy suite. Clinton's longtime Arkansas aide, Betsy Wright, was in contact with him, and what he was saying was problematic for both sides. Ferguson told Betsy that, yes, he had indeed introduced Jones to Clinton, but that Jones was thrilled after the brief meeting and wanted to be Clinton's girlfriend. That argued against Clinton's claim that he didn't remember being in a room with Paula, but also disputed Jones's claim that Clinton had harassed her. An additional tidbit helped us. Betsy told me that Paula approached Ferguson after publication of the Spectator story and asked, "Do you think I can get some money out of this deal?" So the situation was messier than I first hoped, and I was angry about the fact that Clinton had let me go through the charade of trying to prove he wasn't in the room when in all probability he was. But I still believed that Clinton's private behavior as governor wasn't necessarily relevant to his performance as president, and that it wasn't fair to treat a flirtation as if it were a felony. That was the core of the argument I would make to Leonard Downey, executive editor of the Washington Post. On February 17th, we met over crab cakes in the dining room of the Jefferson Hotel. On the understanding that everything I said would be off the record, I came prepared with notes sketched on a long yellow pad, a political brief for why the Post shouldn't run the story. Despite the sordid subject matter, I felt like a man on a noble mission. Not only was I serving my boss, I was also taking a stand against the tabloid culture. I imagined myself in the tradition of presidential advisors called to solemn deliberations with barons of the Fourth Estate over how to balance the public's right to know with the president's responsibility to govern. I began by flattering the Post, emphasizing that our extraordinary efforts to keep Paula's account out of their paper demonstrated our respect for the Post and our belief that whatever appeared on its pages would rightfully be taken seriously by the rest of the world. Then I turned to Paula's credibility, her 3 years of silence, her refusal to rule out book and movie royalties, and her association with the conservatives, I argued, all called her story into question. People who worked with her in Arkansas, I added, have also told Isikoff that she was an unreliable employee who seemed to have a crush on Clinton. Next, I served as Clinton's character witness. I told Downey about the moment when I had told the president about Paula's press conference. When I mentioned her name, I told Downey, Clinton had drawn a blank, and he didn't seem to be faking when he claimed that he didn't remember meeting her. I also tried to use Ferguson's testimony to our advantage. Sure, he puts Clinton in the room with Jones, I argued, but you can't take half his story and throw away the rest. If you believe Ferguson, then you also should believe that Paula Jones didn't feel harassed at the time. Downey hardly said a word. Polite but imponderable, he heard me out, asked a few questions, took some notes, and thanked me for my time. He was doing his job, and I was doing mine. And though I don't know what role our conversation played in the decision, I was proud of the fact that Isikoff's account didn't appear in the Post until May 4th, the day after President Clinton retained attorney Bob Bennett to represent him in the impending civil suit of Jones v. Clinton. With the statute of limitations for Jones's legal claims set to expire at the end of the week, Bennett had first tried to negotiate a preemptive settlement with Jones's lawyers. In the initial phone call, Jones's lead attorney, Gil Davis, took a hard line, saying that Ms. Jones was all but certain to file suit and that she was prepared to discuss the president's private parts. But when the settlement talks heated up on the afternoon of May 5th, Bennett camped out in my office so that he could personally consult with Clinton on the final details. The president was in the Oval, working the phones for the House vote on an assault weapons ban. Despite intense lobbying by the National Rifle Association, we were within a few votes of victory, and Clinton was doing all he could to put it over the top. I shuttled between the two sets of phone calls, but I should have known after our cliffhanger victory on assault weapons that Paula Jones would actually file her lawsuit. In Clinton's world, good news rarely arrives without a shady companion. Early in the afternoon, Bennett thought he could buy more time. He called Davis from my easy chair and said that he couldn't get an answer by today. It's a busy day at the White House, and this is not a decision I can make. The offer Jones had on the table was for the president to read a public statement confirming that they had met and apologizing for any defamatory statements about Ms. Jones from him or his staff. Although it would later seem like a small price to pay, at the time it appeared unacceptable. We couldn't agree to subject the president to such a public spectacle over an incident he had previously denied. In addition, the Jones attorneys were asking us to sign what they called a tolling agreement. That meant we would agree to suspend the statute of limitations for Jones' sexual harassment claim, and they would reserve the right to file a lawsuit at any time in the future. That was a non-starter for us. If we agreed to a settlement, it had to be final. We couldn't run the risk that as Clinton's re-election campaign approached, they would concoct a reason to refile the lawsuit. The Jones team pulled out of the negotiations with the excuse that they needed a tolling agreement because they couldn't trust the White House not to trash Paula, and they waved around their threat to reveal President Clinton's distinguishing characteristics. When Bennett and White House counsel Lloyd Cutler reviewed the details, Clinton reacted vehemently, without hesitation, and offered to have a urologist examine him and file an official affidavit on the spot. But later, when we were alone in the Oval, he seemed more dejected, and I tried to buck him up by saying that we would still make history when he was reelected, despite all this garbage. "You may be right," he responded, skeptical. "Annie Jacobs told me that I'd be remembered with Adams and Truman as a great president who was vilified while in office because he was doing tough things." Clinton understood how fierce his enemies were, and he was willing to pay the personal price for advancing his public agenda. He also knew that he had no distinguishing characteristics, but he failed to comprehend the complexity of his own character. Had he been able to predict how he would react as Paula's case made its way through the legal system, Clinton would have never permitted it to go forward, if only for the harm it would do to everyone and everything he cared about. Me neither. In retrospect, the risk of a tolling agreement seems painfully small. But who knew? In May of 1994, Monica Lewinsky was still in college. The Japanese prime minister had the American president on hold, and Clinton wasn't happy. But his impatience on the morning of May 24, 1994, had more to do with domestic politics. A few hours earlier, the polls had opened in Kentucky for a special election to replace the late William Natcher, a courtly Democrat who had cast a record 18,401 consecutive roll call votes over a 40-year congressional career. Although no Republican had been elected from Kentucky's 2nd District since 1865, the president was worried about this race. Shielding the phone with his right palm, Clinton said he wanted to be campaigning. "It's Nazi time out there. We've got to hit them back." Campaigns, he always said, were his best friend. But that morning, he was blind to his own political predicament. Our Democratic House seat was imperiled, all right. But letting Clinton campaign would only have made matters worse. In 1994, the voters just didn't like their president.
Republican polls showed that only 30% of the voters in that Kentucky district thought Clinton deserved re-election, and even half of the Democrats polled thought it was time to send him a message by voting Republican. Whitewater, Paula Jones, and other missteps like gays in the military weren't our only problems. By the spring of 1994, even our legislative successes were working against us. The Brady Bill and the assault weapons ban had enraged and energized members of the National Rifle Association, but the general public didn't know yet that crime was down. Voters heard Republicans call our economic plan the largest tax increase in the history of the universe, but they had yet to feel the benefits of lower interest rates and stronger growth. Our labor base was depressed by the president's all-out effort on the NAFTA agreement they considered a job killer, but the corporate interests profiting from the pact showed their gratitude by attacking our health care plan. Rush Limbaugh and other talk show hosts were fanning all of this smoldering resentment into an angry flame, and Republican strategists had crystallized the intense anti-Clinton mood into a single, devilishly clever campaign commercial, the Morph ad. Thanks to digital technology, voters in Kentucky's 2nd District saw a photo of Joe Prather, the Democratic candidate, slowly dissolve into an image of the president as an off-screen announcer ominously warned, "If you like Bill Clinton, you'll love Joe Prather." Sending a Clinton clone to Congress was about the last thing voters wanted in 1994. Prather lost by 10 points, and the Republicans had a road-tested strategy for November's midterm elections. More trouble arrived in June with the release of Bob Woodward's book, The Agenda. We were in for a media blitz. That was the power of Woodward. What he wrote, people read. His apparently omniscient accounts of how Washington works had toppled a president, exposed the cloistered corridors of the Supreme Court, unveiled the clandestine operations of the CIA, and revealed a White House at war in the Persian Gulf. Now his sights were set on us. For more than a year, he'd been chronicling the economic policy wars inside our White House. His book, as he predicted in the letter I had hand-delivered to President Clinton 8 months earlier, would be the most serious contemporaneous examination of the administration's economic policy. In the summer of 1993, several months into his project, Woodward's first call to me had sparked two simultaneous thoughts. Oh no. And I've arrived. His books invariably created embarrassing headlines for their subjects, but his sources were assumed to be the most important, connected, and knowledgeable people in Washington. I was wary of Woodward, but flattered and curious, too. I also considered it part of my job to know what he was up to and make the best of it. We met for a late dinner at his Georgetown townhouse, where I received the full Woodward treatment. Like so many others who had supped at his table and spoken into his cassettes under the cover of deep background, I was arrogant enough to believe that I would beat him at his own game, that my spin would win. I thought it was possible to soften Woodward's negative slant with context and perspective, or overwhelm it with up-close and personal accounts of the president's public-spirited fortitude, intelligence, and empathy. What I couldn't fully admit to myself was what I surely also knew, that even spinning you think is selfless is an act of self-aggrandizement, especially with a reporter of Woodward's stature. Talking to him in an authoritative way demonstrates that you're in the room and in the know. Working on Woodward's book was my job, but it also fed my ego. Relishing the role of fixer, I encouraged friends and allies like Carville, Sperling, Begala, and Stan Greenberg to cooperate with Woodward. I also urged Hillary to do an interview, gave 3 interviews myself, and handed Woodward's private letter to the president without telling anyone else about it. Taken as a whole, The Agenda is a comprehensive and basically accurate account of how we developed and passed an economic plan that worked. That's not how it played in June of 1994. Appearing on 60 Minutes, Woodward boiled the whole book down to a less than 20-second soundbite. Chaos. Absolute chaos. The agenda was marketed as the most persuasive proof yet that Clinton was an undisciplined and indecisive president leading an inexperienced, out-of-control White House. The repercussions were immediate. Mac McClarty was the first casualty. Woodward's book crystallized the conventional wisdom that Clinton needed a stronger chief of staff from the Washington establishment. Mac was a good man, a successful business executive, and a close Clinton friend, but he had never worked in Washington, and Clinton never gave him real authority. When Clinton was first considering Mac, I encouraged the choice,
myopically thinking that my relative wealth of Inside the Beltway experience would increase my own power within the West Wing. But even before the agenda was published, it was clear we needed a change, and even I wanted a tough chief of staff who would corral the president and keep his headstrong independent operators, like me, in line. I knew Mac's replacement, Leon Panetta, from Capitol Hill, where he was chairman of the Budget Committee and a close friend and ally of Dick Gephardt. A former Republican, Panetta was a bit too much of a fiscal disciplinarian for my taste, but he had a big heart, first-generation immigrant values, and an infectious laugh. When he said that Clinton wanted to talk to him about replacing Mac and asked for my advice, I was encouraged. But I was still in trouble. Everyone has a blind spot. Mine was on the issue of loyalty and leaks. I was trying so hard to stop bad stories that I thought I was immune to being blamed for them. I assumed I was part of the solution. But the president and Hillary were beginning to think I was part of the problem, and the agenda became their proof. The overall impression left by the book was bad enough. The quotes attributed to me were even worse. "You've got to always keep in mind," Stephanopoulos said to one of his closest associates, "that watching Clinton is like a kaleidoscope. What you see is where you stand and where you're looking at him. He will put one facet towards you, but that is only one facet." Woodward also wrote, Leon Panetta was up next. Campaign aides had told him that Clinton was deadly slow to make decisions. "The worst thing about him is that he never makes a decision," Stephanopoulos had said. Woodward's attribution clearly indicates that he didn't get these conversations from me, but I had said things like this inside the White House when I was trying to explain Clinton to my new colleagues. These closest associates, or one of their closest associates, then passed the anecdotes on to Woodward. Whatever their provenance, the quotes appeared far more damning in the black and white type of a number one bestseller than when they evaporated into a West Wing hallway. And my unvarnished assessments, combined with my earlier advocacy of Woodward's project, enraged Clinton. Which means I didn't hear about it directly at first. I rarely took Clinton's outbursts personally. More often than not, they passed right through me. But I did worry about his silences. I knew Clinton was raging about Woodward. He had to be. But he didn't discuss the agenda in my presence. Hillary didn't mask her anger. Over the next several weeks, the agenda became her single-bullet theory for our summer troubles. "The whole problem with this administration is the Woodward book," she said. "It's hurting us overseas, and it's the reason all our numbers are down. There are people who go out there with no loyalty to the president, no loyalty to the work we have to do for the country, just seeking to aggrandize themselves, and I hope they're satisfied." I wasn't, disloyal or satisfied. Deciding to grant such broad access to Woodward was a mistake, a naive lapse of judgment. Had I been more mature and disciplined, I might have seen that there was no way to win with Woodward. A less authoritative account would have been less damaging to our agenda in the short term. My open cooperation, however, was not an act of treachery, nor was it the sole source of our political turmoil in the summer of 1994. In late August, a 3-judge federal appeals court panel announced that they were replacing Special Counsel Fisk with a new independent counsel, Kenneth Starr, who would reopen the entire Whitewater investigation. Chief Judge David Sentell's opinion argued that Fisk had a conflict of interest because he had been appointed by Attorney General Janet Reno, a decision he reached after lunching with Republican Senators Locke Faircloth and Jesse Helms. We thought this decision was outrageous, but unwisely failed to challenge it. So after 6 months of a grand jury investigation, 2 rounds of congressional hearings, just when it looked like Whitewater was finally over, it was starting all over again. Despite a complicated diplomatic success in Haiti, our poll numbers were stuck in the mud. The shrinking deficit was fueling a growing economy, but people didn't buy it yet. And the failure of health care overshadowed legislative successes like the Family and Medical Leave Act and the Brady Bill. A new wave of Republican war fads were taking their toll on Clinton's psyche, and he was having a visceral reaction to being portrayed as a cardboard cutout of himself. But his answer, to demand a series of ads for the November 1994 elections, centered on how he kept his promises, wouldn't work. Even if people liked one of his policies in the abstract, support tended to drop when Clinton's name was attached to it. I heard the president out and dutifully relayed his ideas to our consultants. But in the fall of 1994, President Clinton was the unfortunate opposite of King Midas. Everything he touched turned to lead. On Election Day 1994, Governor Mario Cuomo lost. So did Marjorie Mezvinsky, Speaker Tom Foley, the old bulls Rostenkowski and Brooks. Senator Harris Wofford, the Kennedy man whose special election upset 3 Novembers before had foretold our 1992 triumph, lost too. Democrats everywhere were defeated, but not a single Republican incumbent running for governor, House, or Senate lost. The Republicans won back the Senate, captured a majority of governorships for the first time since 1970, and took control of the House for the first time since 1954. Our nemesis Newt Gingrich was now Speaker, 2 heartbeats away from the White House. In December, I found a fragment of a Republican newsletter in my inbox and taped its frayed edges to the center of my desk. It will take not just a comeback, but a miracle for Bill Clinton to win in 1996. Just seeing those words made me feel better. They had the power of a lucky charm. Little did I know that Bill Clinton had been reaching into his past to retrieve a talisman of his own. Dick Morris was the dark Buddha whose belly Clinton rubbed in desperate times. When I had first joined Clinton's team, Morris was just another unsavory figure from Clinton's past, an ex-advisor with a grudge and a story. A few times in 1992, I had knocked down a Morris-related rumor about Clinton's 1990 campaign, something about how Clinton had decked Morris on the porch of the governor's mansion. Aside from a single reference in October 1993 to a poll conducted by his old friend, Clinton never mentioned Dick's name in my presence. In late 1994, however, I had picked up an unfamiliar frequency in Clinton's monologues. A few times that fall, I could tell that someone new was wiring his way into Clinton's brain. The president would wander through my back door during his phone and office time, saying, "I was just talking to someone." He would then recite a fully developed revision of his stump speech, propose a brand new script for the DNC ad campaign, or launch into an extended critique of the political advice he was getting from Stan Greenberg and the rest of our consultants. After the 94 election, as Clinton withdrew from those of us on staff, the clues were silent but still visible, like the boldly inked crib sheets the president slipped out of his folder during meetings, or the anonymous calls announced by Betty Curry that Clinton would take in the privacy of his study, or the yellow post-it notes left by his phone, reminding him that Charlie called. Charlie was Dick's code name. The president had engaged him to run a covert operation against his own White House, a commander's coup against the colonels. The two of them plotted in secret, at night, on the phone, by fax. From December 1994 through August 1996, Leon Panetta managed the official White House staff. The Joint Chiefs commanded the military. The cabinet administered the government. But no single person more influenced the President of the United States than Dick Morris. As Dick's power grew, mine receded. I still participated in White House policy meetings. I still helped prep the President for press conferences and other public appearances. My office wasn't moved, and my title stayed the same, but I was a presidential strategist in name only. Clinton had known Morris for 17 years. When they met in 1978, Dick was a fledgling consultant scouring the country for candidates, and Bill was an ambitious attorney general of Arkansas looking to make a move. They bonded by poring over polls and bantering about campaign strategy the way baseball fans study box scores and relive their favorite plays, and together they won. But it wasn't an easy or an equal relationship. When Dick looked up at Bill, he saw a future president. When Bill looked down at Dick, he saw the devil he knew. The part of himself that confused power and popularity with public service and principle. Dick knew how to win, but by the time he met Bill, he wasn't scrupulous about how he did it or whom he did it for. His other clients were Republicans, and his attack ads were the roughest in the business. Word was that he would work both sides of the same race if he could get away with it. So after Bill became America's youngest governor, he fired Dick for being, as Morris put it, an assault on his vanity. 2 years later, Bill had become America's youngest ex-governor. Tried to do too much too